Hello and welcome to Eco Justice Radio here on 90.7 KPFK. My name is JP Morris, and today we have a wonderful interview hosted by Carrie Kim. She talks to National Parks Conservation Association's Director of California Deserts and National Wildlife Programs, David Lamfrum. But before we get to that, we have Words from the Front. And this week's Words from the Front is brought to you by Jack Eit from SoCal 350.
Labor Day. Think U.S. workers unionized, coming together to strengthen communities, to advance general prosperity, to oversee creation of sustainable cities, food growing next to wild ecosystems, transit connected, resources managed, rank-and-file union members paid a fair wage with labor rights and worker justice tantamount. Labor Day also serves as a reminder of the importance of countering the often oppressive power of corporate employers backed by the law and muscle of the U.S. government, and sometimes the oversight of labor unions bought and paid for by these very same interests can become part of the problem for their workers. This Labor Day, along the Gulf Coast of Texas and Louisiana, we have seen mass inundations of Superfund sites, at least a dozen in Houston proper, explosions at Arkema, a French-owned chemical plant in Crosby that lobbied Texas Republicans against implementation of safety rules. Petrochemical plants across the region have been flooded and forced to shut down, including the Chevron Phillips and two ExxonMobil refineries responsible for the emissions of unusually high amounts of volatile organic compounds, thousands of pounds of sulfur dioxide, among other carcinogenic substances. No impact to the community has been reported, ExxonMobil in Beaumont reported, with no oversight. Our extreme dependence on volatile, toxic, carcinogenic, and climate-fouling fossil fuels endangers workers along our so-called chemical coasts, either on the Gulf or in our own ports of L.A. and Long Beach. The vulnerable communities that host these behemoths face disaster when the predicted climate chaos arrives and purposely inadequate safety plans go awry. We must adapt our ecosystems to the risks of rising seas and the threats of superstorms and extreme flooding. We must build resilience into our communities through enforced planning and zoning, with climate adaptation at the highest priority, proper toxic waste disposal attended to, chemical safety measures enforced with proper oversight. Burning fossil fuels releases carbon, trapping heat in the atmosphere, leading to extreme global heating. Glaciers melt, sea levels rise, hurricanes form in the warming waters, and these same coastal communities get another wallop. We must reduce, and maybe someday end, our reliance on fossil fuels. We must retrain the workforce for an era of green jobs for all and stop enabling expansions of petrochemical facilities. Hurricane Harvey promises to be the most expensive, unnatural disaster in U.S. history. This Labor Day, let's support the health and safety of rank-and-file union members and their communities by calling for a just transition to a mixed economy based on clean and renewable energy sources. We cannot afford to pretend we aren't next.
Thanks, Jack. And now with our interview with David Lamfrum, you're listening to Eco Justice Radio on 90.7 KPFK.
You're listening to Eco Justice Radio on 90.7 KPFK. My name is Carrie Kim, and we're here with David Lamfrum. David Lamfrum is the Director of California Desert and National Wildlife Programs for the National Parks Conservation Association. David is passionate about protecting our natural, cultural, and historical resources and inspires others to engage and become guardians and effective stewards of Mother Earth. Welcome, David. Many thanks for joining us.
How's everybody doing?
Excellent. Well, that's a relative question. So, water is life. This is the definitive mantra of our times. As Chief Arvel Looking Horse, spiritual leader of the Lakota Sioux, says, water is the first medicine. And this is especially true in a desert. Ominously, water is becoming the new oil, being bought and sold for private profit by corporations. And today we'll be discussing the proposed Cadiz Water Project, which would irrevocably harm the Mojave National Preserve. David, can you tell us the uniqueness about this desert region and why we should be concerned about preserving the Mojave?
Yeah, I'm happy to. And, you know, the first thing I want to do is just say that the Mojave Desert and deserts in general really kind of get the short shrift. Deserts make up about a third of all the land in the world, and deserts are some of the most diverse, most beautiful, most ancient, and most sacred lands in the entire world. And I feel really lucky and blessed to live in, I think, one of the most beautiful places in the entire country, the Mojave Desert. And for folks who are not familiar, the Mojave Desert is actually the wildest place in the lower 48. It has the most wilderness areas, the most national park lands, and it's the most intact. These are landscapes where you can walk for days and days and days and never cross a paved road. Places where you can find trees that are thousands of years old and plants that are thousands of years old. It's a place that tells the story of antiquity. There's one particular plant, the creosote. And the creosote has a name. It's King Clone. And scientists have estimated that that plant is over 11,000 years old.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
And regularly, you know, you'll be walking through the desert and you will see these humble plants, 2 or 3 feet tall. And that you'll come to learn that that plant may be a thousand years old or older.
Wow.
And that's because in a place that's arid, where you have very little water, growth happens slowly. Our idea of seasons really come from having four seasons. But in a desert, you could have a decade without a tremendous amount of rain.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could have rain every year for a couple of years. So growth happens irregularly, and species have to be hardy.
Can you talk about some of the unique wildlife? You mentioned some of the plants that are thousands of years old. Can you mention some of the uniqueness of the wildlife that inhabit the Mojave?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So in my kind of second job, I'm a wildlife photographer. And Mojave is an incredible place to do wildlife photography. So one of the species that we go out and look for a lot is the desert tortoise.
Mm-hmm.
The desert tortoise is an iconic species here, a really unique animal, a species that digs its own burrow. That burrow could be 20 feet long or longer, and they spend 90% of their time underground.
Wow. I didn't know it was that much time. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, and the reason that they dig these deep burrows is they actually are digging down to a level in the ground where they can have the proper temperature and have the proper humidity.
Mm-hmm.
So they dig until they get to the right place.
And the bighorn sheep?
When you think of the valley floors and the creosote flats and the yucca and the Joshua tree forest, those are areas where you'll see a lot of desert tortoise. And as you get up into the mountains that, you know, are found all across the Mojave Desert, you get into the habitat of the bighorn sheep. And the bighorn sheep is an incredibly hardy species. And it's a really, really big mammal to be living in such an arid place. So the Mojave Desert is one of the hottest and one of the driest places in the Western Hemisphere. So bighorn sheep have adapted to get much of their moisture from the plants that they eat.
Mm-hmm.
And just like bighorn sheep that you may have seen on BBC or National Geographic, usually around October or November, the males start battling for dominance, and you can actually hear them clanging horns.
Mm-hmm.
As they're battling up on the mountainsides. And so Mojave National Preserve especially is a great place to see bighorn sheep. But after, you know, many, many decades of recovery, the bighorn sheep are actually doing quite well in the Mojave Desert.
I was speaking with Emily Green recently, and she had mentioned that the Mojave is such a unique ecological gold mine, and most Californians have no idea what we have in our own backyard. And we would love for you to tell us now what the Cadiz Water Project is about.
Well, so I have the privilege of doing a job that I really love, and it's also a really hard job. My job is to protect the California desert, and sometimes that means having to basically run campaigns to, you know, oppose large industrial projects.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cadiz project is a really unique project. So there's basically private land in an area that is now surrounded by national monument. And that land, underneath it, runs water And a lot of that water is basically water that's left over from the Ice Age. And that water flows down from mountains in the north, from Mojave National Preserve, slowly flows all the way down to a dry lake bed. Mm-hmm. And the Cadiz Project is basically a project that wants to intercept that water, mm-hmm. pump it up, and then ship it to a giant pipeline along the I-10 corridor, mm-hmm. and sell that water to Los Angeles and Orange County.
Now they...
No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, they like to claim that this is a conservation and recovery project, it's a storage project, it's kind of all these buzzwords and euphemisms, when in actuality it's an extraction project.
Right. When we discuss this project, the term that we use is water mining.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really gives kind of paints the picture of what's happening here. There's also, I think, an issue that a lot of Americans would care about, which is an issue of fairness, where if you own a piece of property, should you be allowed to pump out not just the water beneath your property, but the water that's beneath all the other properties that include our national parklands and our national monuments and our wilderness areas? That's exactly what's happening here with the Cadiz Project. Beyond even them wanting to take water, I think what people find so hurtful is that they want to, is the amount of water that they want to take. So they're not looking to take a sustainable amount of water. They're actually looking to take between 50 and 75,000 acre feet a year.
Wow.
And I think that comes out to something like 16 billion gallons of water a year. And that would have really significant effects to the desert itself and to our national park. And it would dry up these sacred springs, which are sacred to many of the Native American groups in the desert and that are depended upon by wildlife.
Can you mention some of the tribes that would be impacted?
Yeah, you know, my organization works really closely with the Native American Land Conservancy, with the Chemehuevi tribe, River Indian tribe, with the Paiute tribes, with the Mojave tribes. I mean, they're, you know, one of the great things about the California desert is that they're really large and pristine and intact landscapes, and these landscapes are sacred. In addition to, you know, the fact that we are environmental organizations working to protect wildlife and these ecological systems, we're also working with communities and we're also working with tribes, and we honor and respect the fact that these lands are sacred to them. And we very much want them to be able to, we want these lands to stay intact so that they can be used by all of these people who care about and use the desert.
Can you explain the terms recharge and overdraft, because I think some of our listeners may not be familiar with these terms and how it relates to the Cadiz Project?
Sure. So recharge is really just a hydrological term that discusses the amount of water that enters the system. So it's water is sometimes hard to think about in the desert because of how arid it is. It's very rare to get surface water.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of the water that exists in the desert exists underground, and it travels from higher points to lower points, and it sits in these basins that are underground called aquifers.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this particular case, the recharge means the amount of water that returns through snow, through rain, into the system each year.
Mm-hmm.
And overdraft is basically when you're taking out more water than will be replenished. And so San Bernardino County, where I live, is the largest county in the lower 48. And in San Bernardino County, there's a rule. And the rule is you're not allowed to take more water than is naturally replenished.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems, and it's a really progressive and great rule, and we're glad that the county has that rule. What's really unfortunate is that Cadiz actually was granted an exemption to this rule.
Who granted that exemption to them?
The county of San Bernardino. So Cadiz is really the only businesses or entities in our county who basically allowed to take more water than is replenished naturally. But I think at the heart of this issue, there's a fundamental disagreement about the science. And so on one side, you have Cadiz, who stands to make $1 to $2 billion from taking this water and selling it, who's disagreeing with some of the most respected scientific agencies in the country, like the United States Geological Survey and also the National Park Service.
Yeah, and what have they said?
So Cadiz says that there's a recharge of 32,500 acre-feet of water a year, and USGS and the Park Service think it's something between 2 and 10,000 acre-feet. So there's an incredible difference in the opinion of what can be sustainably taken from this place. And I think that is at the heart of this Cadiz Project.
Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, listeners, we are speaking with David Lamfrom on Eco Justice Radio 90.7 KPFK. So, David, you know, I would like to mention a quote by Senator Dianne Feinstein. And, you know, historically, Dianne Feinstein is considered more of a conservative senator, but she has really been proactive around opposing Cadiz. And she said Cadiz wants to rob the Mojave Desert of its most valuable resource, water. And she said that Cadiz has ignored, as you've said, independent scientific analysis that shows this project would decimate a life-sustaining desert aquifer. So I'm wondering if you could speak about also, I mean, Seth Steyer, who also used to work for you at the National Parks Conservation Association, said that the Cadiz project is like taking a public resource that originates on public land, privatizing it, and selling it back to the public at a profit. So can you speak about the precedent that this would set if the Cadiz project were to go through?
I'm happy to. And, you know, I in listening to Senator Feinstein's quote, you know, it's worth noting that Senator Feinstein has been an incredible force for conservation in the California desert. In 1994, she led the effort to protect 9 million acres, and that created Mojave National Preserve in 1994, and it elevated Joshua Tree and Death Valley from national monuments to national parklands.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked closely together with the senator's office, where last year, President Obama designated three new national monuments in the California desert. That was Mojave Trails, San Jacinto, and Castle Mountains. And so when you're thinking about the Cadiz project and you're thinking about the public lands that would be impacted, this project is basically in the heart of Mojave Trails National Monument and would have significant impacts to Mojave National Preserve. There's a lot of reasons that the senator cares about this, but, you know, I think she understands, like so many of us in the desert do, that when you have these large landscapes and you have so little water, that if you draw down that water and you don't have these spring systems that exist, then you don't have the basic surface water that's required for so many of those species to survive.
Absolutely. Well, can you speak about also the impact of climate change to have a project like this even be proposed when we are dealing with climate change at the same time in a desert environment? What are the ramifications?
Well, I mean, it's a really great question, and it's a question that we don't, I think, fully have the answer to. But you know, one thing I would say is that we know that the desert Southwest is going to be disproportionately affected by climate change. And so we also know that what we're seeing across the globe when we talk about climate change is that there's irregularity of weather patterns. And so for Cadiz to be certain that they can take 32,000 acre feet of recharge, that's based on the idea that you're going to get a particular amount of rain.
Exactly.
And that you're going to get a particular amount of snow.
As if they could predict it right now.
Right. And the reality is that we are really in an age of uncertainty in relation to, like, really how much rain we're going to be getting, how much snowfall we're going to have. And so to assume, as Cadiz is doing, that you can take 50,000 acre feet, which is even beyond their estimate of what's sustainable.
Sure.
To be able to take that for 50 years and for that to have no environmental harm is just truly ridiculous.
I think that's amazing. Yeah, to hear them say it's not even a little bit of harm. It's no harm. That's unbelievable.
They are saying the things that that somebody who wants to make $1 billion would say to try to make that $1 billion. But when you have scientists who have no financial stake basically standing up and saying this isn't correct and this isn't right, to me that speaks to kind of the issue. There's no incentive, right, for the Park Service or for the United States Geological Survey to, you know, really to come up with numbers. The numbers that they come up with are based on science.
Right.
And they don't make a dollar more, however, if the project moves forward or doesn't, why would they lie?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and why would they take that? There's no benefit in it for them.
Yeah, this is a lot like climate change and climate denying. But I was wondering if you could tell us, where is the water proposed to go for this Cadiz project?
Well, so much of the water, and it's worth noting that Cadiz still has to go through a number of steps. So they would have to construct a pipeline. They would have to create these giant pumps. They would pump all this water out of the ground, and they would send it through pipelines across the desert and then down to the Metropolitan Water District aqueduct. And then from there, that water would basically be shipped to customers who would be buying it. And I think the largest customer is currently in Rancho Santa Margarita in Orange County.
Because
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, some people will say that the water for Cadiz is actually being used for things like replenishing the Mission Viejo Lake, private beaches, lawns and pools of suburban planned communities of Orange County. For example, the 14,000 new homes in Rancho Mission Viejo.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I tend not to argue with folks about the need for water. I mean, I think that there's an incredible opportunity for water conservation. And I also think it would be a lot cheaper for the folks in those water districts to think about how to be more efficient with their water than having to steal it from basically the public lands that they recreate on and to ship it hundreds and hundreds of miles. But I do think also that water is a fundamental human right. So I tend not to talk to folks about whether or not they need the water, but I think that we can be smarter about how we source water. The impacts that taking this water would have on this environment when so many other and better options exist, really, and also the expense of this water.
Sure.
Really means that, you know, it's really a bad deal for everybody. Everybody loses in this scenario except for the Cadiz project.
Absolutely. Can you discuss, I'm wondering if you could speak about the difference between water conservation and also the entitlement that it seems a lot of us here in California have around water. Just the history of water in California, how it's been moved, how we have harnessed it, the dams we've made, the way we've moved the natural flow of water, all of it, there's a lot of entitlement that I think is just ingrained in us as Californians, and I wonder if you could address that.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you think about the history of our state, I think back to, you know, people play the game and they say, if you could go back 200 years and go anywhere in the world, where would you go? You know, or if you could go back 500 years, where would you go? And for me, one of the places that I would want to go would be California's Central Valley. And to see these beautiful tule marshes, right, with elk and grizzly bears and all of that water from the west side of the Sierras, from the highest mountains in the lower 48, right, coming down in spring and creating all these wetlands and these marshes and these wildflower fields. It just would have been such an incredible sight to behold.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And as you know, California is also one of the most important states in the country for agriculture. So the damming and diversion and the moving and channelization and creating canals, I mean, is part of the history of California. And I think California has really come a long way from doing things like LADWP and Owens Lake. Right?
Absolutely.
And bringing that water from the Eastern Sierra, for example. I think that California is really looking to create smart water policy now, and I think when they passed the State Groundwater Management Act, they took a big step forward where one of the major goals of that act was to protect groundwater and to replenish and to recharge groundwater. Unfortunately, Cadiz falls into this kind of strange middle ground that they had never really considered when dealing with SGMA, which is what do you do with a basin that is pristine but that is under threat? And so that's why we're working on a piece of legislation called AB 1000.
Oh, yeah, I was hoping you'd speak about that.
Yeah, which is sponsored by Assemblywoman Friedman. And that legislation basically requires that in the Mojave Desert, if a project is going to pump water and transport water, that there would have to be a review by state agencies to make sure that that project was actually sustainable.
And is it enough, you think, to protect it?
I think so. Because this project is, I think, by its own admission, not sustainable.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, David, I'm wondering if you could tell us, this is such a big project, we could be speaking about it for quite a bit longer, but I'm wondering if you could tell the listeners, what are the things that listeners can do to, A, stop the rising tide of water privatization? What can they do specifically around Cadiz and opposing this project, letting their legislators know? What should they do?
There's a couple of things, and, you know, I want to give a lot of credit to communities because Cadiz tried to create a project in the almost 20 years ago, and that project did not work. and they've reconstituted this project and are trying to come back again. And in 2015, the Obama administration actually passed rules that said this project requires federal review.
Yes.
And the difficulty that we're having now is that Cadiz is working hand in glove with the Trump administration. And so the Trump administration is now going in and trying to actually change the rules that were written and allowing this project to move forward without the review that would demonstrate the harm that it would cause to our public lands. That's why we have this piece of legislation, AB 1000, to make sure that there will be some review. And in this case, it'll be a state review.
Right.
So that we can understand the impact that this project will have on these sacred lands.
Absolutely.
And we think that that's a great option, but now we have to pass this legislation.
Absolutely.
And so
there's a lot of support,
I mean, there's an incredible amount of support for this legislation, but if I'm a listener and I'm wondering what I can do about this, you know, what I would do is I would call my state assembly person.
Mm-hmm.
I would call my mayor.
Mm-hmm.
I would call my state senator.
Yes.
And if I had just drank a cup of coffee and I was feeling ambitious, I would call the governor too.
Absolutely. David, can you give us the website where people can connect with you in the national park?
Yes, absolutely. Our website is www.npca.org. I work for the National Parks Conservation Association.
Mm-hmm.
And my organization is, believe it or not, 98 years old.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
We look really good for our age.
Yeah. And are you on Facebook as well? At that same
name? Yeah, we are.
Name?
You can find National Parks Conservation Association on Facebook and on Twitter. We do a lot on social media.
Right.
But, you know, many people may not know that one of the people responsible for creating the National Park Service actually founded the National Parks Conservation Association because that person in his wisdom understood that you cannot protect the national parks from within the federal government. So
got it. Yeah.
My organization, NPCA, you know, we are all working across the country to protect our national parks, and our organization is really
exists, to protect the parks.
We're here to fight the good fight.
Well, mahalo for listening to David Lamfrom. We've been on EcoJustice Radio on 90.7 KPFK. Tune in next time. Thank you so much, David.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And that is it for us. Thank you for tuning into EcoJustice Radio here on 90.7 KPFK. I want to thank David Lamfrom once more for talking with us. EcoJustice Radio is brought to you by SoCal 350 and KPFK. Executive producer Mark Morris, interview hosted by Carrie Kim, and original music by Javier Caudry. I'm JP Morris, and until next time, remember, the power is yours.